Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
9 times.
Mr. Brown. Mr. White.
You know, for kids.
Mr. Blonde. Mr. Blue, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink.
Why am I Mr. Pink?
I see dead people.
1.21 gigawatts.
Their obsession.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
No, I'm just getting warmed up.
Their words.
I'll ask you again. Did I urinate on your rug?
I drink your milkshake.
Someone else's movie.
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god, not the god.
Directors, screenwriters, actors, and film fanatics record feature-length audio commentaries for the films that changed their life.
I want you to get up now.
How come Andrew gets to get up?
That's right.
If he gets up, we'll all get up. It'll be anarchy.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
That's The Sidetrack.
You're out of tune.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Happy Halloween! It's Wolfman Mac Gerber here, and I've been out all evening. I've hit all the best houses, and I'm finally back with a bag of tricks and treats. That's right, we asked you to supply us with questions for the Halloweenies, and you did not disappoint. But before we open up this bag of goodies, I have two Halloweenies here who I like to refer to as Trick and Treat. Which is which? I'll let them decide. Let's throw it over to my brother from the same mother.
Thank you very much. This is and thank you very much, Mackenzie Gerber. I don't think you introduced yourself. Wolfman Mac.
I did, I think. Maybe I
did.
Didn't.
You really? Well, I've already lost track after not even 1 minute of this podcast, so I'm sure this is going to go swimmingly. My name is Postmaster Witchfinder Justin Gerber. I am. They call me Trick. I'm a little tricky. Much like the famous 90s artist, I believe, from the UK. If somebody wants to correct me on that, let me know. And it's going to be, I'm looking forward to answering a lot of these questions. I know that we always answer the questions from our Patreon patrons. They're guaranteed to be answered. And unless they're too similar to earlier episodes when we already answered that question, they can listen to those episodes, I guess, right? But I'm thrilled to be here. There are three vaccines. I'm thrilled to be here.
And let's kick it over to on the other side of the pond.
This is Dan. I guess I'm Treat. Dan Treat Caffrey. Treat Williams.
Treat
vaccines
Williams.
Is a treat. Best Treat Williams movie, hot take, Once Upon a Time in America, I think.
I don't think it's a hot take.
You can keep your Deep Rising and your
Fairy
Tale
Theater.
What's
that movie we've yet to watch, Justin Prince, The City?
Oh, man, I heard that's good. Sidney Lumet's Prince of the City. Yeah. He's the lead. He's like this cop who rats on other cops, apparently, who like tries to work the system from the inside. It's supposed to be good.
I like Treat Williams. I guess I don't have a strong opinion about him either way, but I like what I've seen him in. I actually like Deep Rising. I think it's a lot of fun. And you know what else is a lot of fun is this new vaccine.
Johnson & Johnson.
It sounds like we're promoting it in hopes that we get it, because neither of you have been vaccinated.
Well, to be fair, right? this episode is on the main feed, and it is sponsored by Johnson & Johnson. They do great baby shampoo and saving lives, thank you very much, across the world.
Yeah.
So we appreciate it.
I want it. I want it now. I want it soon. In Atlanta, they just opened up the next category, so hopefully. I'm at the bottom, like most
well,
of us.
We're actually going to, Mac, I don't know if you heard this, in Chicago, we're about to be in 1C, and 1C includes podcasters.
Oh, wow.
We're essential workers.
Cannot wait for that. I hope all of our Patreon members that brought us these questions, I hope they're riddled with vaccine questions as well, because obviously we are at the forefront of knowledge on that. But first off, I'm going to kick it off with our question from Greg Green, who writes, question from a Texan. Can you recommend any horror movies that would resonate with people who had extended loss of power, heat, and maybe even water? He threw out a couple here, but I don't want to mention them until we've... Well, I guess you guys have seen them. It's Krampus and The Shining. So don't choose those. But I thought of a weird one, but I think Sunshine, Danny Boyle's Sunshine, because is actually kind of like, not only
becomes
is
a horror
the
movie
world
at the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only is the world losing heat via the sun, but I think the ship is constantly failing throughout that, and they have to go with less and less resources. And I think that that's kind of a cool way to... I mean, honestly, if you are dealing with a loss of power or heat, I'm not sure how you're supposed to watch anything if you have a loss of power, but if you're in that kind of scenario, I think watching something like this can give you the fun anxiety of that, but not hit too close to home. You know what I mean? What about you two?
It's funny because the movie I immediately picked, I'm trying to think. I'm like, wait, do they? I'm pretty sure they do lose power and heat at one point. In the Lodge, they do, right?
That was one of my picks, too. Yeah.
Oh, well, and I think the Lodge is... I mean, it's funny because I was in... to the fellow Texan, I was in Austin during the snowstorm, and we thankfully didn't lose power or heat. We lost hot water and internet, but a lot of my friends lost pretty much everything during that. So I was trying to think, what would be scary? And I think because... you really couldn't go anywhere, so you just felt really claustrophobic. And The Lodge, to me, really, really plays on claustrophobia and this idea of just being holed up in one place for a long time. And funnily enough, it's the last movie I saw in the theaters before the pandemic, so that movie feels extra scary and resonant for me. So that was my pick. But Trick, I'm sorry I picked your... Trick Daddy, I'm sorry I picked your...
You know, I anticipated. You know, we have a lot of bleed over. I feel like we've known each other for a long time, and you know, this is going to happen. We're going to have bleed over, but that's why I chose a few more just to be safe.
Yeah, go for it.
So I've got the original, in terms of losing power, I've got the original Assault on Precinct 13.
That's a good idea.
The gangs, the main gang, you know, shuts them off, and even though they're at this, you think that the police station would be the safest place to be. Well, you know, if you're a cop. but little do they know that without any power and resources and telephone lines, they're just as, you know, fallible as anybody else would be. Really great movie. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely see it. Because it does kind of like how Sunshine becomes a horror movie. Assault on Precinct 13 is almost like a zombie movie in some ways, with the way that the gang members are totally... there's like very little dialogue.
They're like proto-Michael Myers.
Oh, definitely, yeah. You can see the influence in Halloween.
And it's definitely totally...
And also the influence in Escape from New York, because the lead in that is very much Snake Plissken-esque. And, yeah, for I think for heat and losing food, I had The Lodge, like you said, Dan. And then, in the twist, as opposed to... well, I guess this would be a twist, kind of. I had Waterworld. Because what's the opposite of worrying about losing all of the water? You'll be having too much water. So it was my little twist, kind of like the Midnight Sun episode of The Twilight Zone. I want a little twist there at the very end of my answer. And again, if you haven't seen the Midnight Sun episode of The Twilight Zone...
Oh, that's really good, too.
Isn't there, in Waterworld, there's that one scene where he gets attacked by that weird shark slash whale kind of thing. That's kind of horrific a little bit. You know, it's like, I'd say it's the Jaws of post-apocalyptic water fiction.
I think. I'm celebrating the 27-year anniversary of having last saw Waterworld.
Yeah, no,
so anything you say, I totally believe. If you said, and then a giant gorilla hybrid crocodile attacks Dennis Hopper and takes his eye, I'd believe it. I could not dispute it either way.
The other... I just thought of that. What's the movie with Alan Arkin? Wait Until Dark. It's based on the play, right?
That's another power outage one. That's a good power.
I guess there's a lot of horror movies where the power does go out. I mean, even in some of the Halloween movies, Gremlins. Well, I mean, there's a lot of movies where the power goes out.
The lead in that is blind, and the power goes out at one point because she tries to gain the upper hand, but that's kind of...
But then the refrigerator...
Spoiler alert.
I'm spoiling
the ending.
It. Yeah, sorry. That's the best part of the movie.
But yeah,
it's really good, though.
Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah, Audrey Hepburn's really good in that. And Alan Arkin. I don't know why I'm leaving him out. Who wants to take the next question?
You go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, I'll ask this. This is from David Gonzalez? Good question. It's just kind of a, you know, it's got this is a long-ranging question, wide-ranging question. He says, besides The Thing and The Fly, what is the best use of practical effects in a horror film, and why is it Society? Good question. The Society, the
statement.
Society. Is it Brian Yuzna's Society, who also worked on, I think he wrote or produced Reanimator and those other Stuart Gordon movies.
Had either of you seen? I didn't see that until it was on Joe Bob. I hadn't really heard of Society until then.
No.
Did you all grow up watching Society or anything?
No,
like that?
Malcolm actually watched it on Shudder, but it was not with Joe Bob. I think it was right before, or maybe we just didn't watch it with Joe Bob. But we watched it on Shudder.
Yeah, we just, that was like one of the last flicks we watched pre COVID, right?
You might be right.
You came over and we watched Society. It's so twisted. That movie is effed up.
Yeah.
And the special effects in that are absolutely amazing.
It is funny because I do think the special effects are great in the movie, but I don't know. I not that I dislike the movie necessarily, but it's so prolonged. We only see really the one minor sequence, and then of course the big major sequence at the end of it, the shunting scene. And so it's funny because I know everyone praises the practical effects in that movie, and they are great. But I think because it's not really evenly distributed throughout, it's actually not the first thing that comes to mind for me when I think of best practical effects in a horror movie.
Yeah.
But it is great. I mean, it's a great scene. It definitely is.
What for you? Because the first movies that come to my mind are The Thing and The Fly, so I had to really 100%. Think outside the box. So what were for you?
Totally. Yeah, you know what? I thought about like Alien, Aliens, Gremlins, things like that. Anything with a good creature, right? But honestly, I rewatched it recently, and it holds up so well, especially the effects, is Pumpkinhead. And I think that's because Stan Winston directed it, even though he technically didn't do the effects for it. He actually had he kind of promoted his normal team to take lead on the effects. I think the guy who's in the suit actually handled a lot of them. But they show a lot of Pumpkinhead. They reveal it really strategically, and once they do, it looks great. And they show a ton of motion from it, which is pretty astounding given the year that it came out. You know, you can tell sometimes when they're covering up things, but Pumpkinhead, I mean, you see the entire thing, and it's also a tall creature, which also always freaks me out, height, like really tall beings. And I feel like I people like Pumpkinhead. I don't think it gets thought of as one of the ultimate practical effects movies, but man, I think it's just as good. It's not as gross as The Thing or The Fly or anything like that, but I think it's just as convincing in what it is showing. So that's my pick is Pumpkinhead. But what about y'all?
I have, like you said, Alien, Aliens. Mac, well, I've got a couple, but if you want to list yours.
Well, the first thing I actually did think of was Alien, and I think it mostly, I don't even say special effects, but just like the design, everything in that movie is very tangible. Even some of the mat shots feel tangible. Absolutely the creature design in that, from the chest burster to the face huggers, and like all that stuff is just, it's so in your face. And I know that you don't see the alien a whole lot till the end, but the moment you do see it, it isn't just like CG, or it's not like you see their point of view, like, oh, like you see the alien, like reach out for Dallas. You're like, I love that. And then my only other one was another staple, which is American Werewolf in London.
The transformation sequence.
Yeah, and just all of the people, all of the victims haunting him, like they look awesome. look so good and just distorted and messed up, yeah.
Alien is pretty unique in that you get to see different phases of the creature, which I think is always a cool thing when you see something evolve. You know, you see that in Shin Godzilla and some other creature
Shin
features
Godzilla.
Too. Yeah, I know it's not all practical. A lot of it's CG, but it
that's awesome.
Wait, is there a baby Godzilla in Shin Godzilla?
Kind of. It's almost. It's spoiler alert for anyone's gonna see it. It comes out of the ocean. I mean, I guess it is kind of a bit. It's more like evolving very rapidly. So when it comes out,
so it comes out initially. It's in a baby form esque. But
it's almost like
weird.
Almost like a giant tadpole or something. It has like a waddle on it. It's really freaky.
It's scary.
Like,
I think it's got a good one.
Yeah.
For me, I mentioned, I was gonna mention Alien, Aliens, American Werewolf in London. I think underrated would be Fright Night. I think the special effects in that movie are amazing.
Yeah.
But my choice, I actually say, and I think this is for me easily the least of the three in Romero's Dead trilogy, but I think Day of the Dead, the finale especially, in terms of practical effects in a horror film, is pretty amazing. I always remember there's one of the army guys when he's getting his head torn off, and yeah, he's screaming, and it gets higher and higher because his vocal cords are being stretched. It's just little things like, I mean, obviously that's actually more sound design than this practical effect.
Yeah, but it's attention to detail, but, like, you know, yeah. it's everything coming together, yeah.
And just which really I think if you just have and like people's eyes being ripped out from their skull, it's just
who's the guy who gets disemboweled? Joe Polito, is that his name? Oh man. And but apparently they used like they used actual like tripe for that, like raw tripe.
It smelled awful on the set. Yeah. Because I think Dawn of the Dead is incredible, and so the special effects in that, but just because, you know, it's I think it's 5 years later, inevitably the look of the blood and the special effects just kind of get better and better, and that's why I think Day of the Dead does reign supreme in that regard.
Goes that extra mile. Mac and I always laugh at I think it's the behind the scenes.
I wrote this into the finale here.
Oh, I know what you're going to talk about.
should I save it?
No. We can say it now so people know what it is. Go ahead.
I think it's when Day of the Dead first came out on DVD back in the 2000s, and there's a behind-the-scenes documentary on all of the films, and they're talking to George Romero about it, because Day of the Dead, I think, didn't have a great reputation for a while, and it's improved over time, and so he's talking about how it always has a soft spot in his heart, and, you know, he's saying, oh, you know, people will really praise the prestige of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, but you know, it's the real trolls that love Day of the Dead. he gets this devilish grin on his face, like he really likes the people. And so Mac and I would just always say that. So yeah, the real trolls.
So love them.
Yeah.
Very cool, Dan. Why don't you take the next question? Unless there's something else a lot of movies have good practical effects, but the best.
We mentioned every horror movie that's ever a good special effects.
The Howling has a good, I mean, it's kind
Justin's
of, it's
funny. Justin's laid down the law. We've mentioned it all, folks.
I feel like they always get pit against each other in terms of transformation sequences, but The Howling and American Werewolf, I know. The problem with The Howling is the woman sitting there watching it the whole time. And so it's,
I said the
it,
same
it
thing.
Like,
we've been having this argument for, I think, 15 years. I'm telling you, she's in absolute shock at a monster coming to life. She's in shock.
But there's enough time there where you're like, I could probably get around this thing and walk out the door.
She's in shock. This is the equivalent of, look, if you're going to complain about that, then we can't complain about people complaining about Lori leaving the knife behind in Halloween. Can't do it.
No, that's true.
Oh, no,
that's
I mean, everybody, you can complain about all these things because no one
knows. No, you cannot legally complain in front of me. I don't care what you say about horror. If you're complaining about Halloween, is that Lori?
Justin, I'm going to give you a new name. You're no longer Trick. You are the lawgiver.
Troll. Troll. Troller tree.
They're the real trolls. Yeah. Oh, man. I like that you said Fright Night, though, too. Well, especially as Fright Night, we get a werewolf, we get a vampire bat, we get a vampire. You know, I always like when
and
they
you
have
get Billy.
Special things. Yeah.
The something. We don't never know what he is.
That melting scene.
Oh, yeah,
right,
that is
the
true.
Melting
yeah.
stooge, yeah.
I love it. That's so good. Oh, yeah, I guess he's like the Renfield of the, you know, yeah. of the, yeah. The movie. All right, so this next question is from Dylan Sage. Are you happy with the state that horror is in currently? Are there any trends you wish would come back? Mac, why don't you go first for that one?
I don't have an answer for this. I think I'm pretty happy with the state horror is in, because I think that, you know, honestly, it's kind of like a little bit of an event every time a horror movie comes out, and usually lately they've been pretty decent. I haven't watched anything and been like really disappointed or just like not interested in watching new horror. Like, I'm pretty interested in watching all the horror that's coming out right now. I think it's, you've got a smattering of everything. In terms of trends coming back, I honestly don't want trends to come back. I'm kind of at the end of the road of nostalgia. Like, how many times can we repeat tropes and, you know, pay homage to, like, give me the new horror. Like, what's next? Like, what is the next thing that's going to really wow everybody? Because I can't picture it in my head. And so I'm, like, really looking forward to that. But what about you two? Is there something that's been lost along the way that you'd like to see return?
I mean, it's always funny when it comes to pop culture about bemoaning the state of how things are, how they used to be. I just have always looked at it like there's never going to be a shortage of good stuff to me. I will, if I live to be 100, and I hope I do, I will never get to watch all the good movies out there, including all the good horror movies, right? And I'm someone who watches a lot of horror movies. And I will say this. I do think because of social media, and maybe because we've all been stuck indoors a little bit, doesn't have so much to do with the movies themselves. I do think from a fan perspective, we are labeling a lot of things as great that I think are good or solid, you know?
Yeah,
totally. I kept seeing all this stuff about 2020, like, oh my God, there were like 20 great horror movies this year. And I'm like, no, I think there were 20 good horror movies, and there were maybe a handful of great ones. But I think that's always been the case, right? Even some of the stuff from the 80s that we all love to watch. I mean, I love the Friday the 13th movies. They are certainly not all great, right? There's a few of them, I think, that are great. So yeah, so I think the state of current state of horror is great. I love the prestige horror that we're getting, like Hereditary and Midsommar and The Lodge, things like that. There still seems to be a healthy appetite for really campy, gross horror that we see on Shudder a lot. There's movies that subvert those things, like The Love Witch. I actually think horror is in a more diverse state it is than it was back, you know, in any other decade, both in terms of who's making it, who's in it, and what kinds of movies we're getting. I mean, I guess I would, you know, I always like to see more practical effects. CGI blood I never like, but I also, I don't know, when I watch new horror movies, I'm not like, oh, it's all CGI. I still think there's a lot of good movies with some really good practical effects. So yeah, I agree with you, Mac. I am very much happy with the state of horror, and we have so much access to it now, to the stuff like Shudder. What about you, Trick? What do you think?
Thanks, Treat. I could actually sit here. So I could talk about, you know, bemoan, oh, and you know, in the old days they did this and that, and some of those points would probably be very valid. I agree with you, Dan, to the point where I think that because of the last year, we're all kind of looking for anything, right? So everything will be heightened. So if we think something's pretty good, we might be like, oh, that was really great. And if we think something didn't work, we could get really aggressive about it, right? And I also think, just in terms of trying to get eyes, it only really works if you say something absolutely sucks or something is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people are not going to really interact with you if you thought something was pretty good or didn't quite work. If you use, like, you know, kind of polite terms, you have to get kind of really aggressive or demanding with your takes to get those responses. But that's more about the culture surrounding horror movies as opposed to horror movies themselves. I think sometimes, you know, we see some recent horror movies that have got great premises that have subtext that kind of becomes the overwhelming text. And
yeah,
that, to me,
that,
you know, when you lose the horror of it all. And for me, horror does not mean you have to have blood and guts and 1,000 jump scares. But I think with a horror movie, you do need to have some suspense, some intrigue, and some mystery, at least, if you're not going to have those other elements, right? But I think sometimes we get lost in, oh, well, the whole movie actually meant this, and isn't that great? Well, for me is, well, that would be great, but how's the movie?
Yeah. Well, and you know? Do you feel like, too, I mean, I remember on, and I'm not saying it's not good, or I mean, this isn't against the quality of it, but I remember, I feel like people were trying, and this gets to one of our questions later, but people were trying to, say I May Destroy You was like a horror series, and I'm like, look, I'm not knocking the quality, and there are elements of it that are definitely disturbing, but I don't know if I would call it horror. There wasn't a monster, there wasn't a killer in it, there wasn't some unexplainable thing. There were things that were, I guess, humanly horrific about it, but yeah, I'm like, this is not genre wise a horror movie. I
guess
see a lot of that.
You know what I'm thinking? Because Mac, did you ever see I May Destroy You, Mac?
You know, I started watching it, but the content, I wasn't there.
It's heavy.
Mentally at the time.
Yeah, it's
I think the comp
continue.
Would be.
I'm gonna come back to it.
The movie comp would be, I guess, like The Accused, right? If you want to say The Accused is a horror movie, because there's definitely horrific. You know, there are horrific elements in it, but I don't think it's a horror series.
Horror is very tied
to crimes against humanity and things that are awful. Things that happen to humans happen in a lot of movies, but that does not necessarily make it a horror film. And I also think I'll not say that, because I think that kind of lessens horror. But I from what I watched, and I got a few episodes in, I really liked it. I would not categorize it as horror necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I think with horror there needs to be a certain type of amount of strategy behind it. Like there are tactics that you're using to scare people, which is different from tactics that you're using to unnerve people and hit at their thematic buttons, right? And a horror movie can do both those things too, of course. But I do think there is I think horror movies have to be much more mechanical, even prestige horror movies. There has to be a certain amount of schematics into place that are solely to scare people, I guess would be my criteria. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but yeah.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
I'm going to move it to the next question, which is from Rudy A. Martinez, who writes, have you ever read the script for the unproduced Thing sequel? This is Return of the Thing. It was supposed to be a two-night event on Sci-Fi back in 2005. Frank Darabont was going to produce it, great, and possibly direct. And it was written by David Leslie Johnson, who wrote on The Walking Dead, Orphan, Conjuring 2, and upcoming third movie. As soon as I saw Conjuring 2, this is me not talking, this is Mac talking. As soon as I saw Conjuring 2, I thought, oh no, like, what is this going to be? However, after reading the synopsis of both parts of the miniseries, I guess, or whatever, in this review that Justin sent to us, I actually liked it a lot. I was actually, I mean, in terms of what can you do with a direct sequel, I thought it was pretty interesting. Justin, you have a synopsis of it, right? Or do you have a brief synopsis of it? Or
I can, if, well, Dan, had you ever heard of this?
I had heard of it. Honestly, this was the first time I had really done any investigating into it. You know, I had read the synopsis of, like, the Thing video game and some of the other the comics, some of the things that come out after this. But yeah, this is the first time I just read the synopses and kind of skimmed the scripts a little bit. But cool. Yeah, did you read the whole thing?
Well,
Jason,
it's like you're reading two movies in screenplay form. And the thing with reading horror screenplays is so much of it is visual. So I didn't want to give it a judgment with the script. But I did read. Mm-hmm. I can read this breakdown that is from Patrick Soriel. This is back in like 2009, by the way, folks. This is a long time ago, from Corona Coming Attractions. We do appreciate the drink Corona. I'm not sure if that was the actual sponsor of this website, but I can blaze through this if you want. If everybody wants to sit back and listen, I'm just going to read the synopsis pretty much. I'm not going to go into the
details,
the play by play, or the ending, or the twists and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it actually begins with a recap of the final showdown between Childs and McReady before flashing ahead 6 months and Soviets hear fragments of Windows rescue call during the first winter storm, and they arrive at the destroyed camp. They find the frozen bodies of McReady and Childs and salvage what they can. So McReady and Childs, according to this version, were both human after all.
But, I mean, if they were just frozen, then maybe when they thaw out.
Well, no spoilers, but that's not the case for this play, at least.
Yeah,
for this show, at least.
No spoilers, but yeah.
And so, but then most of the story actually jumps ahead 23 years, which would make sense if this came out in 2005, right? Because I think the Thing was 82. And it follows two storylines. It follows Little Bear and another man named Gates, who chase after the Thing Coyote, which is kind of akin to the Thing Wolf from the original. And to try to contain the spread of the organism by killing the other Thing-infected creatures. And also follows Lukanov, the members of the government strike team, and the townsfolk of Christmas. Most of this takes place in New Mexico, by the way, which is kind of a twist on the cold to the heat, you know?
Yeah.
And they come to realize that several of them are not human anymore. A lot of this sounded to me like it was almost like a backdoor pilot to a series.
It could easily have been. However, the way
like
it goes
Galactica situation, you know?
Towards the end, you're just like, holy crap. I mean, if it became a series, I think it would have been really like over. I don't know what they would have done, because you would have had to go. I mean, like, because it definitely goes outside of Christmas at the end. You know what I mean? Like in terms
yeah,
of.
Yeah, it seems.
It would be more like global or even, you know, all of the United States or something. And you could do a ton with that, I think. But I don't know how long you could keep that going.
Yeah.
And it would be really expensive. Because if you want, you know, Bottini special effects, excuse me, if you want those special effects, I mean, that's going to get really expensive, I think,
well,
over the course of the entire
series.
That's
the scare, right? Because, you know, who's doing the special effects for this 2005 Sci-Fi Channel movie? You know, I don't know how great it's going to look.
Wasn't that around the time of Battlestar Galactica? I mean, wasn't
that
like that
would have been
good sci-fi stuff?
Yeah, but special effects-wise, we're not talking about like it's a different type of special effect for making fake Cylons.
Yeah,
like,
but
Cylons.
I do think that
this is like, you know, your stomach's ripping open with teeth. You know what I mean?
I guess
I feel like this would be CGI hell.
We presuppose that Rob Bottin comes back.
Nah, no way.
What I'm just saying is like I'm saying per the, per what I read, that was the version I was trying to look at it like, you know, like if it was very practical effects heavy, then yes. But again, like you said, Justin, so much of it relies on the actual execution. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like reading a comedy. I think comedies and horror are like the hardest things to replicate live or as a play or something like that. And I think when you're reading the script of that, so much is in your imagination. And translating that is the hardest part. So, you know, we really just have to be like, okay, well, if it was produced in the way that I'm envisioning it, yeah, I think it could have been really effective, you know, because I'm envisioning it with all of the same special effects, all an actual sequel to the thing, you know what I mean? Like, that was the version I saw in my head, and I was like, yeah, I think this could be pretty good. It almost was kind of like a mashup to me in my head of, like, the remake of The Blob. The way that the thing runs rampant in the town, it's because they had the Blob and the Thing, a very similar assimilation kind of goopy, gross, you know, taking over the town kind of thing. Except the Thing's worse because, you know, it doesn't just kill you, it turns you into the Thing, and then you're running around, you know, it's another Thing running around, you know. So, yeah,
it's also tough too because if the goal, I mean, once again, we don't know if it was a backdoor pilot for sure, but if it was and they expanded into a full series, I almost feel like you would have to go further into the Thing's mythos at some point. And what I like about the Thing is that it's pure instinct, right? It's not the Cylons that have all these spiritual and philosophical undertones and motivations baked into it. And I almost feel like if you kept the Thing going as a villain, you would have to get into some of that, which would be stupid, but I don't know.
Well,
I mean, it's like
you said,
so hard to tell.
Something towards the end of the screenplay, there's a moment where they, and again, I think this would have worked as a short little miniseries sequel. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would have worked as a series, but they realize that electrical impulse disturbs it. So like, and they hearken back to the moment where when the doc puts the electrical pads on
when he collapses
his chest, and they're saying that the reason why it did that was because once the host was dead, technically or whatever, like it didn't like the electrical impulse, so all of a sudden it tried to get away, and that was the secondary test. Because they're like, well, what if the blood test? What if it learned how to avoid the blood test thing? So they're like, what else can we do? So they go that route, and then what they do is they get a thing, they trap it, and then they start doing the electrical impulse, and then after repeated times of electrocuting this thing, it starts to change its forms into prior forms that it's had, and you see some of the old people from the Thing that it had become. And then you see like the alien insect civilization that brought it to Earth, and then you see other forms, and then it says it cycles through like hundreds of forms until finally it gets to its true form. And then they left that out, they said they didn't want to spoil it, but then they did say that I think it does have a dialogue exchange between like very, very, very simple, just basically like, you know, like I want to end you, like I just want to like consume everything.
Hello, I'm the Thing, I want to kill everybody,
you know, I don't want to just be you, I want to be everything. But it is kind of like that, but I did like the idea of seeing all the other alien civilizations that it's taken on. I think that's a really cool idea.
Do you see like the Predator skull or anything like that?
Hey, I'm not kidding. You could throw stuff in there and just be like, yep, we're going to say the Thing is the master monster of all time. You know, it's taking
like
over all these species.
It turns back into Kurt Russell. He has a cameo. He just goes, miss me? And the episode ends.
It was just him laughing from like an audio commentary track. Yeah. Oh, by the way, yeah, so part one of this was called Infection. And listen to part two. This is definitely screams the year 2005. Part two of this miniseries was called Extreme Amplification.
Oof.
Yeah,
and that's
I think you would just go with amplification. That's pretty extreme in itself.
I know.
Already.
Well,
I don't
we
know
have
if you
to
need to you know, qualify it.
Hey, I'm surprised it didn't have like the spelling of extreme, like no e. It's like fuck yeah, fuck. This movie's fucked up.
And I think they had like the idea of like the hunt of the Thing with those two guys. They were calling it like Skinwalker because that's like lore, you know, of shapeshifters. And I like that. I like bringing that into it. That was kind of cool. I don't know. I genuinely was like, no one's tried to do this. So, yeah, I think it's a pretty decent idea. You know, like, it all depends on the execution. But, Yeah, I don't know. The good news is
that they ended up making the Thing movie with all CGI, and everybody hated it in 2007.
I gotta say, I don't like the movie as a whole. Like, I don't think it quite works, but it's really fun if you are a big fan of the original Thing. Or not the original Thing, but the remake of the Thing, because it really perfectly does kind of set up the next movie. And they pay so much attention to detail to that film that I have to give it that credit, where it's like, it's fun to see, oh, there's the axe on the wall. I mean, basically, if you go watch the scene where MacReady and Blair go to the facility, or not Blair, but the, was it Fuchs? Sure. They go to this facility and they, you know, they're looking at everything and all the bodies and ice and all that stuff. And then you go watch the movie. It is so good about like showing how that room exploded, how this. That's very fun. But the movie, yeah, it's kind of like you just kind of remade it. So if you're watching in order and you watch if you watch in order in terms of like the remake first and then the Thing, it's kind of the same movie. So you can't really do
it.
It's
so confusing to talk about these because like.
They're
the
all called the Thing.
Movie
too.
Isn't really a remake, but it's called the Thing. And then the 1982 movie is the original, but it's also a remake.
You know, right. So well, I guess is the first one called The Thing from the Thing
another
from
world.
Another
Thing
World.
From Another World. Yeah, so I'm not.
And then in the book, the story is Who Goes There? Too,
which is fun. Yeah, Who Goes There? That's a great
name,
title.
By the way.
I actually have there's a sci-fi illustrator I really love called Douglas Barlow, who he has all these collections where he just illustrates different creatures from different science fiction and fantasy novels. And he does the Thing from he may have even done this before the 80s movie came out. And it's kind of just like, you know, half husky and then half blue, weird, shapeless tentacle thing. It's a really cool drawing. You can probably find it on Google. If you Google Douglas Barlow, the Thing, it'll probably come up.
Not to Kurt Barlow.
Yeah, not Kurt
another
Barlow,
blue
dude.
Baddie.
You don't want to search for him. Yeah.
Well, at least in the TV series.
Yeah.
So this was a two-part question. The other quick question is: have you ever considered doing a full episode on unproduced horror scripts? I think that's a pretty good idea. I just don't know how many we get our hands on that would
we've
be worth actually doing. I mean, we've covered some. We talked about certain. We've definitely included it, but doing a full episode, maybe even. I don't know what that would look like. I mean, obviously, we would come up with different categories and a totally different kind of way of dissecting it. But
yeah, because somebody said, like, would you like a fan cast? But things like that get complicated when it comes to rights and literally reading dialogue and reading an entire script that was probably leaked and not just given away for free to the internet. You know.
And I don't feel, we're all writers. Like, I don't know how I feel ethically about that too, right? Like, just reading someone else's work without paying them. I'm looking out on my desk right now. I have the book Taking Shape 2, which is all about the Halloween scripts and projects that never came to fruition. And, you know, they don't include, I'm not too far into it yet, but I think they maybe include portions of the dialogue. They don't include the whole scripts, but I mean,
That's fine.
You can find them out there. I mean, I've read a lot of the alternate Halloween ones, and we've talked about some of the Friday the 13th ones. I mean, yeah, it's weird. I personally feel like it's maybe better just sort of baked in tangentially to what we're already discussing, you know? But I don't know if there were enough of them, like a case of Halloween where there's so many of them, enough to fill up this huge-ass book from Harker Press. I mean, yeah, we could probably do some kind of episode. It could be interesting, I think.
If you want to look for samples, if you're new to the pod... I mean, honestly, actually, in our only other Trick or Treats episode that Mac was on with me and I think Mike, we talked about the Nick and Tosca Friday the 13th reboot that would have come out in the teens, and that takes place in the late 80s. We talked about that for quite a while. I think we actually broke down the entire story.
We also, if you go back to Halloween 4, we talked about that unproduced sequel idea, and which is so cool.
Dennis Acheson script.
It's a good script.
Yeah, the Acheson script. Would have loved to.
I feel like that's my favorite alternate Halloween script that I've read. The original H2O one isn't bad either. I mean, it's
I gotta read. I gotta get this book, Dan.
It's good, dude. It's they're both good. I got both of them for Christmas, and they're X. I mean, they are so comprehensive. I can't remember if I told you guys this. In Taking Shape 1, which is just about the production of the whole series, pretty much. They talk about how when Mustafa Akkad when they decide on Halloween 4 and they decide to bring Michael back, that he sent like an invitation to the release party, like, but from Michael Myers, which is so stupid because Michael Myers doesn't talk. There are tons of I thought I knew everything about this series, and there are tons of stories like that where I'm like, oh god, you know. So they're excellent. I haven't read Harker Press also has a I think they have a whole book about. the Jaws ride at Universal. Same authors too. Yeah, it's really good. I'm like I said, I'm not through the second one yet, but I highly recommend it.
Well, have we talked? This would actually figure in. Has anybody ever read the Jaws the Revenge novelization?
No, I have not.
Because it's based on the original script.
Is it good?
It's wild because there's a whole subplot of drug dealers, and this is just from the script. This is from the script. This is not me being insensitive, but there's this whole, because they get with Jamaica, you know, whole subplot with drug dealers who end up like the head drug dealer ends up on the boat at the end and gets eaten by the shark when he's trying to kill Michael Caine's character, who has been a courier for the drug dealers. here's the biggest part though, is that the reason, you know, it's so stupid that the shark follows the Brodies from New York to Jamaica. The reason is because Mike Brody's been down there, you know, interfering with the wildlife and infuriating the local Jamaicans, including some people who practice voodoo. And so they put a voodoo curse on the family. And then there's a lot of stuff in which we follow the POV of the actual shark itself and its thoughts. And we realize that the shark has been cursed by this voodoo woman. It's an incredible book to read, though. It's crazy. It's insane.
Now, Dan, you say you haven't read this, but I think you have, and I think that was the original inspiration for Matawan.
I do have a play about the first shark attacks in the U.S., and the shark is the main character. And yeah, I said, you know what? I'm going to take this voodoo priestess idea.
Get rid of the voodoo priestess. Get rid of that.
It's called Weekend at Amity.
I was going to say, because isn't the second Weekend at Bernie's, right? They do the
Yes. Man. I can't imagine watching that now.
Jaws the Revenge, much more interesting and exciting of a movie than Jaws 3, I will say. I do not get bored by Jaws 3.
It's the ugliest looking movie I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, it's awful, man.
I'm not going to kill another shark.
The one part in Jaws the Revenge, because I actually think I think the opening is actually pretty spooky of Jaws the Revenge, but the part, because Mac just did the Michael Caine impression, the part I like, it's so cringy to me. It's where, is his name Hoagie or something?
Sure,
it's Hoagie, right? Hoagie and Ellen Brody, they're like flirting with each other at this parade sequence, and it goes on so long, and she's like just kind of dancing around. He's like, oh, I'm really like following her. It's it's just like old people flirtation that just, it goes on too long. It makes me cringe. I don't know.
Calm down, Caffrey. Like, old people can have love too, right?
No, I know they can. But people always talk about the shark, this or that. I'm like, I can get that sequence just makes me like uncomfortable. I don't know. Maybe I need to examine.
It's the degloving scene from Gerald's Game and Michael Caine dancing with Lorraine Gray and Jaws.
Not a fan of widower Brody finding love again.
She's dishonoring her husband's memory.
Oh, gosh. All right, who wants to take the next question?
Not Justin? Carry the
Trick.
Torch.
Yeah, you go ahead, Trick. Go ahead, Trick.
This is a fun question. It's from Andrew Fabry. If you were going to be a late-night horror host, what would your host name be? What would be your shtick? And what film would you play for your first show? Okay, I can answer this one for myself. Okay. I pay homage to Angus Scrim because I'm a tall man. And I call myself like the Scrimster. You know, like, ooh, the Scrimster is back on a Saturday night at 10 o'clock Eastern time.
Not just Scrim Gerber.
Yeah, Scrim would be too on the nose. Scrim Gerber. It sounds like a fake movie critic of like a Rob Schneider movie or something. I definitely have a top hat and glasses and a pencil-thin mustache. Well, I would play it very straight. I wouldn't be over the top because there's options. You can be over the top with it or very like serious, you know, foreboding. I'd probably have like a little bit of a really bad British accent. And my first movie I would show, which would kind of indicate what I like to see when it comes to late-night horror hosts and what movies they show, I would show Dead and Buried. Because I think that would set the tone.
Yeah.
Not the greatest movie of all time, not the greatest horror movie of all time, but
it's cool though. I like it.
My focus would definitely be on like '80s, mid '80s horror movies for sure. I think those are the most fun to watch late at night. You know, and you can have commercial breaks and not have it really screw with the mood. So yeah, that would be my answer. Good question, Andrew. That's fun.
Yeah, you go, Mac.
Oh, okay. Well, my name's already kind of like that,
yeah,
Wolfman
there.
Mac. But I came up with a few others, and I want you guys to vote.
Trick and treat,
us or the listeners?
both, you know, on, hit the socials and let me know. Mr. Gory Gerber. That's one.
Why not just Gorber?
Jack Horror.
Jack Horror.
And Professor Shark Eyes.
Oh.
A little reference to Shark Eyes. Reference to Scary Stories read by what's his face.
Joking aside, I probably would do something like Wolfman Mac and then have it set in like a really scary radio room. I think I'd have like a pal, like a marionette black cat that talks or something. I think for the first film that I would show, because scarily enough, by the time I think I would be able to start producing this show, it would be well into the next decade here, which makes movies like Fright Night like 30, 40 years old, which is crazy to me. I would show Fright Night because I think that's kind of like a great introduction to that. Like, if people aren't familiar with this kind of show, well, here's a show about a show like that, you know what I mean? And so it's kind of like, now you know what we're riffing on and now you can be part in on the joke. And that would be mine. What about you, Dan? Have you come up with any ideas now?
Yeah, so I remember I got off Facebook for at least for the foreseeable future, but a few years ago on Halloween, I remember I was bored. It was when I still was working at Groupon, and was bored at work, and me and a bunch of people, you guys may have been on this thread, I don't remember, we just started doing like bad Halloween horror puns for our names. It just got really silly. And I think mine was Dan Cat-Freak, like F-R-E-A-K. I beg, you know, you could also do Dan Cat-Free, like, you know, squealing. As far as my character, I think I would almost want to do almost like Robert Prosky and Gremlins 2, like not really scary, you know? Either something where I'm just like dressed up but not actually doing a scary character like he is, or something where I'm just a dude, but I'm in like my dungeon full of VHS movies and I'm easily scared by everything, like, so kind of like just an extension of myself, not doing it too creepy. As far as what I would show, I don't know if this would be popular or not. I almost would want to show chronologically like horror movies that stuck with me, so like start with Creature from the Black Lagoon, because that's the first horror movie I saw, or at least the first one I remember seeing, and then go to Nightbreed, which is the one after that, and sort of make it about my personal journey through horror. I don't know if that would be interesting to people, but if just off the top of my head, I think that's what it would be. But yeah, I kind of like, I don't know, when you I watched every Halloween I watched The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad, which is the Disney movie with Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Wind in the Willows, which is not scary. And I kind of like those old Disney movies where the narrator, either you don't see them or they're just sitting there and they're just surrounded by the things that they're going to be talking about, but they're not really playing in any kind of weird character necessarily. I want to bring back that Disney narration style. There's also the,
like,
House of
Pooh
Corner.
Masterpiece Horror.
Yeah, no, yeah, no, totally. Actually, that's a really good way to put it, like a Masterpiece Theater kind,
like Vincent
kind
Price.
Of thing. Yeah. That's a good question,
elegant.
Though.
Yeah.
Bring some class to it.
Yeah, that's a fun question.
Yeah, it's a really good
definitely
question.
Something we'll kick around here in the studio.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'll ask the next one here. But from Bryant Burnett.
Bryant, what's up?
It's always fun to discuss what does and what doesn't count as horror. I recently rewatched some favorite films that almost nobody would classify as horror, but are bursting at the seams with top-notch horror imagery. What are some of your favorite examples of finding the genre's influence outside the genre? I'm going to pivot to Justin. I'm really trying to think of stuff that's not considered horror, but I would consider horror.
Well,
we were just kind of talking about this a little bit. Yeah.
I think a good example, Dan, you mentioned it, would be something like I May Destroy You, right? Not a horror show, but definitely does have horror imagery, right? And what I think of, though, for me, especially in the last decade or so, I'll never forget watching The Social Network when it's revealed that Mark totally had screwed over Eduardo, and you find out during the hearing. And I remember the entire audience just kind of going, oh.
Yeah.
Like, as though you were seeing like a torture sequence. And I felt like that scene and that reveal. And it's from David Fincher, who does have experience with horror, right? Or even like horror adjacent stuff like Seven and The Game and Alien 3, and the list goes on and on. And and you could feel like the walls closing in, and like the intensity and the scare. It felt scary because you realize, oh, this is also based on a true story, and like this is what human beings are capable of. And that to me is like true terror, when you find out like what humans are truly capable of. So that's an example for me of horror bleeding its way into a drama, you know.
For me, well, the first, I promise I'm not even trying to be funny. The first thing that came to mind, I thought this when I saw it originally, is The Passion of the Christ, which is not a horror movie, but I mean, you could argue it's torture porn in many ways. And it's funny, I don't agree with the religious messaging of the movie or Mel Gibson's views on religion or trying to convince others, you know, that God is real or whatever else, but I've always liked that movie because I think visually it very much feels like a horror movie. Not just the violence either, but the way they depict Satan and with the hairy baby in the crowd. And even when Judas hangs himself, there's a dead, I don't know if it's a dead camel or a dead donkey just lying there. The film is just peppered with these really grotesque symbols that I think are supposed to represent, you know, Satan and heaven and good and evil and whatnot. But to me, are just on a really pure raw visual level feel like horror. It feels like horror imagery to me. From what I've read, I think Mel Gibson was drawing more from religious paintings and things, but to me The Passion has always felt like a horror movie. I mean, it has violence, has the supernatural in it. No Country for Old Men was one that came to mind. Yeah. I mean, that almost feels kind of like Halloween to me. And there's even that shot where Tommy Lee Jones is investigating the hotel room and Anton Sugar is just kind of in the shadows and he isn't seen there. That feels very much like Michael Myers to me. But I don't know. I could also see the Coen brothers saying, oh yeah, that's supposed to be a thriller, supposed to be a horror movie. And then one that I saw recently, it's not a movie, but the penultimate episode of The Sopranos, The Blue Comet, where a bunch of stuff happened. I don't want to spoil for anyone who's watching it, but a lot of shit hits the fan in that episode, and the way it's shot much differently than a lot of the other attacks or deaths are shot on that show. It is almost shot like a horror movie. Yeah, I don't.
Is
I mean,
there
I guess
a train
I could go
set
into it.
Involved in that?
The, no, yes, okay, yes, I never exactly. Talked about. Yes, which that feels very like a very so. Hitchcock move. There's a sequence that happens in front of a train set, and mm-hmm. and I think because each of the prominent attacks in that episode almost feel like they're done like a classic horror sequence. The Blue Comet. Yeah, so those are the ones that came out. But honestly, when I read that, the first thing was The Passion. I've always kind of viewed The Passion as a more of a horror movie than a fun religious movie.
Yeah, I was trying to rack my brain here. What comes to mind are like kind of movies that I think are absolutely more dramas with horrific elements. Like a lot of Cronenberg stuff's like that, like Dead Ringers. Mm-hmm. You know, it leaves you uneasy, and there are moments where you're like, ugh. But it's not necessarily horror per se. But horror elements bleeding over into things like first thing that comes to mind for me is what everybody's watching right now is WandaVision. There are moments in that are really unsettling and kind of horrifying in a totally different plane. But I think it's absolutely tapping into that idea, you know, and they do it in a scary way. There's a couple of reveals. I won't say what they are if you haven't seen the show. A couple of reveals where you're like, it's kind of jarring. but yeah, that's all I can think of like right off the top of my head. But
I would say too, with WandaVision, I mean, I think they're very much aware of horror because of that Halloween episode, and they are playing a lot with, oh, what's scary on a superficial dress up Halloween level, and then they get into some real scares later on in the episode when you find out what's really going on. And also too, I think just because they're genre comic book filmmakers, I think they just, and I mean, the Marvel universe itself has dealt with horror a lot. I think like I can tell they're aware of it as filmmakers.
You can tell that they're fans of both mm-hmm. genres.
I think Shudder's done a good job with this as well. I mean, there are movies on that service that aren't necessarily horror movies, but do have horror imagery. I think, like you've met, I think Mac, you mentioned it, like Dead Ringers. It's not a horror movie. It's not. It's a really good intense drama with some horrific elements in it. And they've actually got the Ninth Configuration up there. That's not a horror movie. There are some incredibly intense moments, especially in the climax. But I do like how they're kind of branching out in a way.
Yeah, they're not drawing that hard line, mm-hmm. which I think is great because I think it will introduce people into a lot of great films, but a lot of different genres that might, you know, it's like, okay, well, you don't have, if you love horror, you don't have to just watch horror, you know, like there's other things that are fairly scary that aren't typically horror films per se.
Mm-hmm. What was that one movie? Beast. It was a Shudder original, I think.
Beast is really good.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'd call that a horror movie necessarily. And same actress. One. This is actually kind of funny. So I'm Thinking of Ending Things on Netflix. If you read the book, I'm Thinking of Ending Things. That actually does feel like a horror novel to me. Like I was, and then it was weird because I actually felt like the adaptation as it went on felt less and less like a horror story. But they also made some changes from the book.
Definitely.
So yeah, that line is definitely interesting. That's a good
about
question.
That. Yeah, because I like the movie, but I'm looking at it only from the movie standpoint. I really want to talk to you guys about the book on another day.
No spoilers.
Cool. Well, yeah, I think that's a good idea. That's a good thing to know. And if the listeners have movies that they think are great and have horrific elements, like definitely shoot them our way or throw it up on the socials because, you know, we're all about sharing here at the Halloweenies. And if there's stuff we haven't seen, we want to know about it. We want to see it if it's good.
With Jack Horror...
this is Jack Horror.
And what was yours, Justin?
Oh, the Scrimster.
Scrimster.
Gross. I'm going to come up with, I'm going to draw these characters. I'm not a very good illustrator, but I'm going to do it. Who hasn't read a question? Someone wants to go with the next one. Dan, I think.
Yeah, maybe Dan.
All right, cool. This is from Nicholas Johnson. What horror movie would you most like to dive into on a podcast that you haven't been able to get to? I'm just going to go off the top of my... This is just the first movie that came to mind, and I think it hasn't been covered a lot. I would say The Lady in White, which is an 80s horror movie. Almost, actually, speaking to our last question, almost kind of like a coming-of-age drama with horror elements. It's not a perfect movie. I think as it goes on, it gets less scary, but I love the atmosphere in it. And it actually feels the most... Halloween fall of a movie that I can think of, and I think Lucas Haas is really good in it as a little kid. And I just don't think, even in an age where lots of horror movies have been covered to death, I don't think that one has gotten talked about with quite the attention it deserves. So yeah, that was mine. What about you, Justin?
Well, you know, we're on a network with The Losers Club and Psychoanalysis, just to name two, and so we do try not to bleed over. And I cover the same movies, you know. Inevitably, we were going to do Scream this year because Scream's coming out, even though Psychoanalysis did the first Scream movie last year. But movies like Fright Night, which Psychoanalysis did, you know, Hellraiser, which I know the Halloweenies
we covered
Patreon.
It on the crate.
I'm not the Halloweenies, but this Loose Club Patreon. Mm-hmm. It's all incestuous at this point.
Yeah.
But I would love to do, I mentioned it earlier, the Fright Night Part 1 and 2. I think that would be a fun episode. I could talk about those movies, both of those movies, all day. Specifically Fright Night Part 2, actually, which does not get nearly as much discussion as the original, but which I think is actually one of the best horror sequels ever.
Oh, another example of great practical effects, too.
Yes, absolutely.
Both of those.
For a lot less money, you know. So
It's a film that... It's a sequel that captures... a totally different setting, but totally captures the feel and tone and look of the original film and feels like a direct sequel, and it in many ways is. I think that's a really good idea, Justin. I can't believe we haven't covered them yet. Something huge that we haven't covered that I'm like dying to get to, but I think it could almost be a season. Dario Argento movies, like Suspiria. Like we haven't done any of those Italian horror films. And I, not that they haven't been done probably a billion times, but I think there's so much to say. You know, I mean, so much of that stuff in those films is very ethereal and kind of, you know, take what, you know, you whatever you think it is what you're taking from it, you know, kind of thing in many ways. And then you have some of the straight horror ones. But I think... Suspiria for me, and those flicks like Tenebrae and all that would be awesome to
you
cover.
Watched I know Suspiria isn't technically this, but a lot of his other movies are. Justin, you watched like all the Giallo movies, right? Or not all of them?
Oh,
a
I
lot
think
of them, right?
Yeah, I've watched a lot of his movies, and I think Tenebrae is that's pure Giallo, and that's so good.
I've seen Deep Red.
I've seen Tenebrae, Deep Red. Yeah.
Suspiria. He did. What's the one trill? The Inferno and
Inferno, oh damn, we saw
the
Inferno
church.
Inferno.
Yeah.
Inferno was really good. I think. Phenomenal. I mean, I know as he's gone on, his movies have not been. They've gotten a little more like softcore.
We've talked. It's kind of like some directors peak at a certain decade. Like some people make it to the '80s, some people make it to the '90s, some people make it to the aughts, and then you know, just
if you're, but if you're Martin Scorsese,
you keep going.
Have it all.
I can't wait. Honestly, I can't wait for Flowers of the Killer Moon. That's a great source material, and I think he's going to do a great job with that. Even though they're going through, speaking of horror, they're going through some casting hell of their own right now. I think people keep dropping out for some reason. So
was it Armie Hammer in it or something?
Nah, I think DiCaprio's in it, but then he ended up doing another role in it. So Jesse Plemons was going to take it, but now I think Jesse Plemons is out.
I don't know what's going on over there.
Yeah, you know, I just saw Armie Hammer pop up on the, you know, like when you're on Netflix or whatever, like they give you like the little poster. It was the picture for Rebecca, which. For a long while was a picture of what's her name from it, the girl from Cinderella, Justin and Downton
Lily
Abbey,
James.
Lily James, and then but now it's like a picture of him and her in the background. It looks very much like something that you'd like from Hannibal, like no joke, I'm not kidding. And I was like, are they trying to capitalize on this?
Would.
Like I was like, this is so weird.
I think they'd be doing damage control, man. But
yeah, you think so?
We wish Armie Hammer all the best.
Yeah, jeez.
In hell,
I don't even know. Yeah, I don't even. Yeah, let's move to the next question here. I'll do it. Tim Neely says, when the Friday the 13th lawsuit is finally settled, could a Pamela Voorhees starring reboot work? And there's a second part of the question, but let's run with that first. It's interesting. We've talked about Friday the 13th quite a bit. I don't think this has ever come up. I think you could do a reboot where if Pamela Voorhees... I could see a reboot where you do Pamela Voorhees being the man behind the mask, or you know what I mean? Like being like a female, you know, Jason, like have the mask still, but it be Pamela Voorhees. And actually be the idea that she's killing the counselors because they killed her kid and not ever have Jason come back. But Jason, obviously the name will still live on, but Voorhees would be the thing that would be the, you know, the legend of Voorhees, you know, continues, but it's just that, you know, different dimension version where it's just, it actually is Pamela coming back time and time again. And maybe it's not her, maybe it's her as a human in the first movie. And maybe in the sequel, she comes back from beyond the grave. But, I think you could do that. I'd be interested. They definitely haven't done anything like that. So, you know what I mean? Like how many more movies can we get that are just a straight remake of the original? What do you guys think?
I think I might don't quote me on this. There's a series of Friday the 13th comics that are not too bad. I think they're from Wildstorm or IDW, one of those companies. I want to say there's like a prequel that's about Pamela Voorhees coming to Crystal Lake when she's younger and having Jason and all that. Now I'm not saying, I mean, you hit a brick wall at a certain point, right, when Jason dies. But I don't know. The first thing that came to mind when I read this question was kind of a Bates Motel version of them being at Camp Crystal Lake together. And maybe it does get supernatural at a certain point, because the thing we always debate with Jason, if you don't follow Jason Goes to Hell, is, okay, well, how did he go from a little boy to being a grown man, all this other stuff. I think there would be a really cool way to stretch out the series in this kind of prequel way and then maybe end it when... you know, with the first campers coming to Crystal Lake. But I don't know, it's so easy to get lost in the weeds of that kind of stuff. Part of me is like, do we just start over Friday the 13th and just do something completely different, you know? Because my big problem with the 2009 one is just it's all homage, you know? It's actually one of the few series where I'm like, yeah, actually reboot that. Maybe you could do something cool with it. So, yeah, I'm a little wishy-washy on my answer to this question. But what about you, Justin?
You know, I'm on the record. I think Friday the 13th, the original, I think that is the best... movie in the franchise. Having said that, I think for a Friday reboot, you know, as I get older, I always put on my producer hat, right? Like, sure, I think actually what you said, Mac, with having somebody running around with a hockey mask on, they used to assume it's Jason, and it turns out it's Pamela. Like, that's a really cool twist. But from a producer standpoint, it has to be Jason. And do we want to get into part two of this? Because I guess part two is like, what would you like to see in a Friday reboot?
Yeah, so
I guess so. Like so bouncing off of that, I'll say
it has to do with something you've created, Justin.
Well, yeah, my thing is a whole expansive thing that's really like a pipe dream in terms of like consumers and stuff like that, and like the impossibility of some of it. But I'll say this: I think so. In reality, for Friday reboot, you just really make it really simple. And the fact is this. Jason existed at some point. Pick and choose what movies you're talking about. People are aware of him having existed. He hasn't been seen in years. people go to Go Camp, hire a really fucking good director, and make the movie. Like, I don't think we need to oversimplify this or make it simplistic. Just make it simple. There's a huge difference there. You know, just do it. There's so many great visionaries out there that have these great looks. Like Oz Perkins. I think sometimes his movies try a little too hard. Or what's a criticism I can make here? He's got an incredible eye, but I think sometimes his storytelling is lacking. So what better project to give him than the Friday the 13th movie, which has the simplest story already laid out for you? So now you can really just lean into the visuals of that. Now, I'm not saying he'd ever do it, but hey, David Gordon Green did a Halloween, so maybe Oz Perkins could do a Friday the 13th, you know?
Yeah, and I have two ideas. One's funny and one's legit. The first one would be, and I think I mentioned this before on another episode, but I would love to see its present day in the universe of that. It's been 20 years or however long it's actually been since the last Friday the 13th movie. They've taken Camp Crystal Lake and turned it into a place where people have weddings. They've redone it, and like the barn is like a where they have the barn or whatever it is. Like they've turned that whole thing, and so everyone staying in the cabin and at the place is there for a wedding, and then Jason comes back. Because it would be so cool, I think, to see. You'd still be in the element. You'd still have all the camp elements there and everything, but you'd have a totally different cast of characters. You'd have old people, children, you know, anybody that would go to a wedding. You know what I mean? Yeah. I just think that'd be cool. And then you could have a really cool band, you know, guest star as the wedding band or something. You know, ultimately that would be. I think that would be really good. And then if you go the part six route and amplify, go to extreme amplification of that idea and. That was a throwback to the earlier thing.
The thing.
Extreme amplification. And you do, basically, it's you actually do Jason Takes Manhattan, but you do it like Sex and the City, where you have Thomas Hayden Church as the voice and narrator of Jason, and it's very much just him, like, now he was left in Manhattan, and now he's trying to make his way, just living his life in the city.
There I was, just a boy with a machete and a mask. Who knew what the big city had in front of me?
I didn't know what was in store. Oh, we get Harrison Ford back to do the narration. I didn't know what was in store. But then again, who does? I'm not alive anymore.
I think we joke, but I do think, you know, between stuff like Deadpool and Cabin in the Woods and Final Girl. I mean, Deadpool's not horror, but you know what I mean? Like, there is this metafiction is, you know, it's very in vogue right now. I could see them doing that, just like a really... You know, and then Jason's trying to get out of this and become a killer. Get like he's like, oh, I'm stuck in this like romantic comedy thing. Or I mean, I was gonna say doing just a Jason Takes Manhattan where we showcase Manhattan a little more. It could be cool. You know, just kind of course correcting a little bit. And yeah, and this question came from John Klimczak, by the way, about what you would want to see in the next installment of Friday the 13th.
It's kind of a combination of.
The ones before. But I also, like I said, a friend, I won't go too far into because it is his script. And like you said, we'll see if it happens one day. But Justin Gerber has a very cool idea, I think, for a Friday reboot. Maybe we shouldn't say it because if anyone's listening, you don't want them to rip it off.
Trolls. They can run with my wedding idea.
I know. It's just the wedding. It's just Max.
You know what I think of, Mac, when I think of your wedding idea is, has anybody seen the movie Demon? This Polish movie that came out a few years ago.
No, it's on my list. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It's one of those movies kind of, it's not really, you could interpret it a couple ways, right? I don't know if it's a straight up horror movie either, but it definitely has horrific elements. It's very intense, but it's kind of a take on the Dybbuk story. Mm-hmm. It's a Polish movie. It's a slow burn, but it's very unsettling. I can kind of just see the Jason setting where maybe it's pouring down rain at a certain point and people are kind of happy inside, but you know, if you leave that venue, because we've all been to venues in the woods for weddings, and you know everybody's all together, but you can definitely walk 20 feet away and be in total isolation. You know, I think it's a really fun idea.
You have a lot of couples sneaking off and doing things they shouldn't.
Sure, yes, we do. Yeah, some stories there.
Who do you think? And Justin said Oz Perkins. Yeah, as far as director, who would be good for that? I mean, I agree in that like. It doesn't need to be someone who's great with story necessarily.
Man, just get Jeremy Solinar. Like, I want to get him to do a Friday movie because I think you have to give it that real down-to-earth, gutsy, gross, in-your-face, like, reality of things happening kind of feel again. I think you could take it that route and do it really well. Again, I don't want to see a straight adaptation of Friday the 13th and trying to take it serious. I think if you keep Jason and you want to try to stay true to the lore or the canon and adhere to some of the films or whatever, I feel like you have to stay more like taking it tongue in cheek. I don't think you can do like 2009's like you said, it's pretty much an homage movie where it's a straight, you know, remake of the original material. It's like the remake of three movies basically. It didn't work. I just don't think you can do that anymore. There's just too many of these movies now. I think if you're gonna do it, you've gotta go from it from a different angle. And this isn't like making Man of Steel, where we're taking something that's always been light and turning it dark. Like, no, you're just taking a horror movie and that's been funny, it's been dark, it's been all over the map, it's been in space, and just making it a more realistic feel, which I don't think they have done since the first film.
Yeah. I actually watched, it's funny because I know I didn't hate it as much as other people, but I wasn't crazy about it. You know, I know Adam Wingard got tapped to do this Blair Witch sequel, and I really like a lot of Adam Wingard's movie. I wasn't a huge fan of that one, so part of me is like, do we need to give him like another remake or reboot, sequel, whatever you want to call it, kind of thing. That being said, I mean, when I look at the aesthetic of Year Next and just how he handles crossbows and survival horror and stuff that comes up a lot in Friday the 13th movies, I'm like, oh, I could see him doing that if he just had a really bare-bones, simple script, wasn't trying to do anything too crazy with it. I also just watched that horror movie Alone, and I was looking at the director. I guess he's like famous for the Universal Soldier movies or something.
Yeah, David Hyams, I think. Hyams.
I thought the directing in that movie was really out of this world, and I think he had such a good grasp on what the wilderness looks like and how to use the wilderness to your advantage. And it's a super simple movie. I really enjoyed it, so I think he could be a good fit. I mean, it's always tough with directors because, you know, it's not like you can have, everyone has their dogs in their past, right? And you could be awesome and maybe through no fault of your own, totally bungle a movie because of studio interference. Or, I mean, there's a million things that can happen, especially when you're dealing with existing IP, I feel like. So it's tough.
Naming the director was kind of, I think, there was actually somebody who asked that question for this episode, but we'd answered it in the last episode, I think, and it kind of bled its way into this one either way, so I think that's why I removed it. But I think in the last one I said Deborah Granick, because she did Winter's Bone and she did Leave No Trace. Now, again, we'd be looking at a prestige director, as it were. But you want to talk about like Capturing the Woods. I mean, she does an incredible job in those two movies. Yeah. So that would be a fun Woods trilogy for her to be Winter's Bone, Leave No Trace. You know, these Academy Award nominated films and Friday the 13th, 2022.
Yeah. Well, Justin, do you want to take the next question?
This is a good question because I'm a huge film historian. I'm a film buff. Brett E. Socially Distant Littman asks, okay, we've got a revisionist Academy Awards. If you were to give Oscars for Best Picture, Actor, Actress, and Director for any horror films that probably got shut out due to genre bias, what would they be? So for me, I actually answered all of these. Every category is it for a different movie. Did you guys do the same thing I did?
Yeah, I chose three. I did three different movies.
I actually didn't, funny enough, it didn't do Best Picture, but go ahead. I'll figure it out.
So I did for Best Picture, and these are Psycho, which was not even nominated for Best Picture, even though Hitchcock was nominated for Best Director. And Hitchcock, by the way, let me just do a little rant here. I understand that we want to see the best movies nominated for Best Picture and things like that. But keep in mind, whenever you think somebody's been snubbed for an award or for winning an award, Alfred Hitchcock never won an Academy Award for Best Director. So, you know, I honestly wish you'd just get rid of awards altogether and just have like top 10 lists at the end of the year, have publications put out their favorites and call it a day. Because the Academy Awards has just led to, it's just a nightmare. It's not fun anymore, if it ever was fun to begin with. So get rid of the awards and just, because this is another example. If I asked you what won Best Picture in 1961 for 1960 movies, who's gonna know the answer to that? Hardly anybody. But if I ask you what's Psycho, you're going to know what Psycho is, even if you haven't seen Psycho, you know?
What did win the best picture then?
I have no clue.
It wasn't Psycho. It's probably like, I don't know, like an adaptation.
And you know, it could have been a great movie. Who knows? I'm just saying Psycho is one of the greatest movies of all time. So for best actor, I would have Dwayne Jones, Night of Living Dead. I think he's absolutely fucking great in that. And I think he is easily the best actor in that movie. Like, he's just great in that movie anyway. For best actress, how about Dee Wallace for Cujo?
Oh, man. We had talked about that on the... Were you on the...
No, I wasn't on the episode.
The commentary, we talked about how good she was. Yeah, I think we talked about how... It's funny with these movies because, yeah, Cujo doesn't deserve to get Best Picture probably, but that there can be a performance within these movies that definitely... I think we specifically mentioned her. Yeah, she's fantastic in that.
And I think... I don't want to step on any toes, so I'll write down somebody else here to remind myself if nobody else says this person. But there's somebody in recent time
I think this should have
been nominated. But I'll keep going.
Oh, I have someone who has been talked... The movie's not recent, but has been talked about recently, very recently, that I had on there. But I don't know if it's the person you have.
Yeah, go for it, Dan.
Best director...
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Danny Boyle for 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
I mean, digital, the use of digital, that's such a groundbreaking movie, and that's the best way it works. And I added another one here. Best score, Goblin, Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go. That score is fucking
amazing.
That's
such a great score.
All right, so there you go. That's my... those are mine.
Oh, great score. That's a good idea.
So I had for best actress, I had Shelley Duvall for The Shining, which is, once again, not the movie's not recent, but there was that article about her a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Just, you know, covering that. I think she... I don't know if it's just because knowing what she had to endure, but also just... People always like to say, oh, she's like a doormat character, she's not good, blah, blah, blah. But I can't think of, for me, I can't think of another performance in that category where I just believe so much that this person is scared for their life. You know what I mean? And yeah, I guess you could argue, okay, maybe it's not the most emotionally complex role, but I think just in terms of like convincing the audience that, oh my God, she is so frightened of what's happening to her, I can't think of another example. Best picture, and it's funny because I completely agree with you, Justin, about awards. When I think about, I mean, every now and then, yeah, you get a thing like Parasite that wins,
sure.
Right? Where I'm like, oh, that's like an interesting movie. I don't even need the movie to be perfect. I just want to see more provocative, different feeling movies win. I mean, you have a Moonlight, you know, right? Like, you know, we are maybe getting to the point where some of those movies are getting like Moonlight and Parasite to me didn't feel like anything else that came out those years. The year it came out was my favorite movie. It was It Follows, and you know, it's, I don't know, I was not a huge fan of Under the Silver Lake or whatever the next one was, and I the director, to me, sometimes I'm like, does he really know what he's doing thematically? Because it's easy just to say, well, it's up for you to interpret, you know, and then you're like, well, yeah, true, but also like you have to be going for something, right? And I don't feel that way about Silver Lake, but It Follows, I actually feel like the movie is in total control of what it's doing. It feels completely unique as a film overall, and also as a horror film. Just the idea of making someone slowly walking after you scary. Like, I had not seen another movie do that. And I just really like where it's at aesthetically. And he feels in control of what he's trying to say while also leaving it open-ended enough for the audience to talk about it. Like, everyone has a theory about that movie, and I feel like when it came out, it was, if you talked about horror movies, it was just the, you know, all that was like what came up. I mean, it's maybe my favorite horror movie of the past like decade
I've loved that movie.
I think it's brilliant. And hey, I think he's a Florida State guy too. Went to our alma mater or somewhere. Yeah, but
Florida State.
It follows for me. And we'll, and I don't know. I think he's kind of falling out of favor a little bit for a variety of factors. But Neil Marshall, The Descent, I think is The Descent is fantastic. Even acting
fantastic.
Awards, I feel like
I think it's fantastic.
Marvelous.
Come on.
Sometimes I can't remember what we've talked about on the pod and what's in our text.
I know.
But for
I know.
Listeners, we're just imitating
Kelsey
Grammer.
We've just been doing a lot of Schwarzenegger impressions lately, folks.
And Kelsey Grammer, too.
And Kelsey Grammer, yeah.
I should have also mentioned this. Sorry to cut you off, Dan, but...
No, God, those are my choices.
These are movies that I mentioned that the people were not even nominated for. So, Get Out was nominated for Best Picture. Mm-hmm. So that's why I didn't include it here. But I'm just saying, Psycho was not even nominated for Psycho. So,
Best Picture. Was Hereditary nominated for anything?
That's where I'm getting. Can I go?
Yeah, go ahead, Max. Sorry.
Did you list everything, Dan? Were you done with yours?
Yeah, that's everything for me. Yeah.
Okay. I
Best Actress, Toni Collette. I don't know. Was she nominated? No, she wasn't, right? No.
Yeah. And that's
nuts.
Crazy.
That's crazy to me. Her performance in that is so good. And it's so clear that that was not nominated because it's a horror film. You know, it's just ridiculous.
Even prestige horror has a hard time, I think, sometimes getting its due.
I think another 28 Days Later, Best Actor, Cillian Murphy in that flick, I think is super good. And that was such a great, like, breakout role for him. Best Director, I don't think that they were nominated at all. I think some stuff got nominated maybe, but for Under the Skin, Jonathan Glazer.
I don't think Under the Skin got
any nominated for anything.
That's crazy to me too,
because I think that is
look it up.
Really real well done flick.
I love that movie. Yeah,
but
this is actually fun. This could be a whole episode.
Oh yeah, I know.
You could actually do like every single category, like best supporting actor, Billy Zane, for Demon Knight. He's great in that movie.
That could be a cool Oscar season.
That's a fun idea.
I would do, and then my other last two, I'm going to go with Best Picture. Because I know that they weren't doing... I don't even know the Oscars were running around, probably. 1928, The Fall of the House of Usher, that silent film.
Oh, yeah.
I think is That's so really good. Good. And really just captures the mood of horror, I think. It's such a good flick. If you can get your hands on it, I think a lot of libraries have it. The 1928 silent film version. I think it's French film. It's so good. And there's a lot of really cool modern soundtracks that people have put on top of that. Yeah. And then
Under the Skin has a good soundtrack too, man. I'm forgetting about how.
Oh, that's Best Picture. I'm saying for Best Picture.
Yeah,
but
I'm just looking at accolades.
Score,
yeah, I don't.
I would say. I don't think it was nominated, right? But let's give. Oh yeah, right. But I would give it to Howard Shore's score for The Fly.
Oh yeah,
I think that is fantastic, and
I think this is an episode.
That flick. But what'd you say, Justin?
I think this is a whole episode potentially.
Yeah, I do. I think that's a good idea.
Well, you know what we could do? We could all dress up in suits and everything, tuxes, and record it or something like that.
Yeah, record
we do
Zoom.
A red carpet show.
Record the Zoom. Yeah, we'll do.
I mean, the bottom line is this: horror movies have been shunned
together.
for like a century. They always will be for some reason. You think? I mean, I know comedies kind of also get the shaft, but horror movies even more so, and it's a shame. Yeah.
All
right. There you go. Let's just run through these next two.
What's the next
like
one there, Dan? You want to take this one?
Yeah, I'll take this one. I would gladly take this one. This is from Grant Herson. How many of the Puppet Master movies do you think are better than The Irishman? Now, I was a real Puppet Master head growing up.
I was say, the guy that said none of Friday the 13th was better than The Irishman, I thought you were going to start talking about how you thought Puppet Master Zulon's movies
Revenge.
Were better.
No, I don't think any of them are better than The Irishman. I mean, I know this is just a joke, but I mean, for real, I don't think any of them are better than The Irishman. That being said, I mean, I love the first three Puppet Master movies. I still have all the action figures. I got Pinhead, I got Leech Woman, I got Tunneler, I got Torch, I got Jester.
Do you really?
Blade.
I don't think I've seen any of these.
I got them all in my closet.
You open the closet, they're not there anymore.
You open the closet, and he has the case. He opens it up, just like in the original cover. You know?
Caffrey's Revenge.
But I love those first three movies. I think, I mean, they're like, you know, low budget, but the puppet design's really cool. William Hickey's great as Toulon. The first three movies I think make up a really cool trilogy. Four and five is when they get into the alien race of the totem, which is where it feels just not creepy.
I like
to
that
me.
Fourth one though.
I mean, it's kind of fun. It's like they're fun. They just stop being scary, and then after that, they just become. I haven't even seen all of them. They just become like recycled footage.
Yeah.
And
anytime you see them move, it's recycled footage, which is a bummer.
I do think I haven't watched it yet. I've heard The Littlest Reich, which I think is with Thomas Lennon,
it's polarizing.
What do you guys think?
But I actually enjoyed it. But I'm look, I'm one of these people that likes to kind of have the envelope pushed a little bit. It's very unpleasant.
Is it really okay?
And
I'll
very,
have to watch it,
it's a messed up movie. I understand why people wouldn't like it.
Is it like a satire of Puppet Master movies, or what?
No. I'll let you watch it.
All right, I'll put that on my list.
If it was a smarter film, maybe.
I mean, so my answer is that none of them are. But if I was going to choose, but I will stand for Puppet Masters and still the action figures and say that the first three definitely I think are a good trilogy. Four is like what, and then five loses me. But I at least respect four and five because they're doing something different. Then after that,
I watched
just
Retro Puppet Master.
A Retro Puppetmaster, yeah.
Which stars...
isn't it the guy
Mark
from
The Room. Oh, he's Young Toulon.
Oh, he's in it? Greg Sestero?
He's Young Toulon.
Wow.
He's like the star of the movie. Guys? He's trying to put on like a French accent or a German accent. It's so bad.
Oh, man. What about you guys? Would you consider any of the Puppet Master movies? I mean, I guess I've only really seen sat through like five of them. All the other ones I've just like I
cursed the Puppet Master and all that stuff.
Yeah. What about you guys?
No.
Yeah.
None of the Puppet Master movies are better than The Irishman. But I think this is a fun question to bring up the Puppet Master movies.
Yeah.
I've seen the first three, and then I've seen the new one that just came out. But I've maybe seen bits and pieces of the other ones. You know, I can actually say I've definitely seen a lot of the other films because I've seen the first three movies because most of it's recycled.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's like a stretch of three or four movies that it's just like the Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 approach to the whole franchise. I mean, Six Shooter, he's a great puppet. I'm just remembering.
But
yeah.
Isn't there like
laugh.
Puppet Master versus Doll Man, or am I mixing up?
Oh,
is that
God,
Demonic Toys?
Some of that.
Versus Demonic Toys, yeah. It's like another Full Moon property.
Yeah,
The first few are really cool because, I mean, Full Moon is never known for its high budget or its prestige, but I really think those first few are really making do with what they have and are really effective. I mean, there's some really creepy sequences in the first two movies, especially. It is funny, though, how the Puppet Master series, in comparison to The Irishman, is somewhat of a unifier among us because I was the only one who said that The Irishman is better than all the 13th movies. But it seems like we can all agree that The Irishman
is
better.
Well, because what The Irishman set out to do was that more successful than what Friday the 13th set out to do. And I was saying, no. I think Friday the 13th set out to make this movie, and they did it better than The Irishman did trying to make this movie.
We, to be fair, look, we retired this bit with...
that's true, yeah.
But look, you know, if somebody asks a question, we're going to answer the question. You know, these are...
Yeah, I agree.
These people are on Patreon. We're going to answer the question.
Give you the goods.
My answer would be...
When you're in the rewind.
My answer would be no. I think The Irishman is better than all 11 or 12 Puppet Master movies, but there are still, like you said, Dan, there are some enjoyable... entries in the franchise for sure.
Yeah, so. No knocks against Puppet Master.
And just last one, I feel bad even asking it because for this bit to really work, Vanderbilt has to be here.
Yeah, because I'm not sure what this is.
Yeah, it's the Milo Notice joke. Where we always talk about, is that the one where all the cats and dogs died? And the answer is yes. This is the one movie where all the cats and dogs died. Matt Elliott, there you go.
Matt Elliott, what's up? Yeah. I immediately went to, I'm like, wait, White God? I'm like, no, there's no cats in White God.
Yeah, I was really racking my brain.
It
was such a
my
deep cut
skip.
Joke. Yeah.
With Milo and Otis, though, isn't it just the dogs? Did they go through a bunch of cats, too? I thought it was just the dog. Was the dog
off, like,
fighting
the
bear?
Stuff like that, didn't they?
I thought it was like the dog fighting the bear. Yeah, I don't know, man. I didn't even know that.
I think they use like 50 cats. I mean, this is no joke. Maybe this is a urban legend thing, but I swear they were like throwing cats off of like cliffs and shit, like for effects.
Oh, man.
And
wait, is the movie Russian or something? What is it? It's not American, right?
No, I think it's somewhere in Asia. I can't remember if it's Japanese or Chinese. Or
so funny, man. I like that movie as a kid. I used to watch all. I had no idea about it.
Did they do
history.
Like an American version where they filmed like American people?
No,
in
it's
parts
just
of it? Is it literally
it's just
straight
a different
up
narration.
About the okay, so
Dudley
it is,
Moore does the American version.
Yeah, I'm getting that mixed English up version. With like Homeward Bound, you know, having like there's a human element to it, you know. Yeah,
because Homeward lived. Bound, they have celebrities voicing the animals themselves. Milo and Otis is just omniscient narrator, right? It's not like a
interesting.
Dudley Moore going like
no
this.
One,
she's
hey,
a
no one
bit
movie
that.
In that genre. I saw parts of it as a kid and liked it, but never watched the whole thing. Is The Bear? Y'all ever see that? It's like a
that
French,
movie for me, I feel like that came out when I was a kid, and we were all kids, and it just didn't really call to me. Like, I think I was going to really enjoy it as a kid.
I
wonder
my
if
dad
it would
watching,
be good
now. I just remember the beginning where I think it's really sad. I think the mother bear is trying to get a beehive or something, and then she falls off a cliff, and then that's what kicks off the story is the baby bear. But it's really like, I think it's like pretty impressive for what they, because I think the movie gets a lot of accolades for not mistreating the animals.
They weren't throwing bears off of cliffs.
And still making this really thrilling movie. I mean, it took years to make, I think. But I was thinking about watching that, because as a kid, I remember that opening sequence and being very moved by it. So, I think that same guy did Two Brothers, which is the tiger movie. So, he's definitely working in a genre. We're sorry Vanderbilt isn't here, Matt. I know that, that joke works.
There are three bear movies that I'll recommend. It's The Edge with Anthony Hopkins and Alec Baldwin, and The Revenant, and I think there's a bear in Benji the Hunted.
There's a really, actually no joke, I won this Blu-ray, I think it was at a Music Box of Horrors when they did the trivia. I don't remember what the question was. I won some trivia question. You could go down and pick like a from a bunch of Blu-rays, and I randomly picked this bear survival horror movie called Backcountry. That's very good. It came out a few years ago.
I've heard about this, yeah.
It's really good. It's very real stripped down and minimalist. All practical effects. It was excellent. I just kind of got it. I'm like, I like animal horror, so I'll try this out. And there's some really creepy sequences. Definitely highly recommend Backcountry.
I got an update here. Yeah. Okay. About Milo Notice. Now this is kind of going back and forth. Some people dispute this, and people are insisting that's true. It says that many animal cruelty allegations were made against the film, including the alleged killing of over 20 kittens, the director Jesus breaking Christ. A cat's paw, and a cat plunging over 100 feet off a cliff. So, who do you believe? From what we've learned from like people who make movies over the last few years, I'm inclined to believe that probably did happen.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I'm kind of anti-conspiracy theory for the most part. But when it comes to Hollywood
and the mistreatment of animals goes. way back in the day,
I mean, when I hear just about like horrible stories about mistreatment in Hollywood, I'm just inclined to believe it. Usually, I don't know if that's bad or unfair of me, but because think about all this stuff. We won't get too far into this topic, but. Yeah, think about all the stuff with wine scenes and whoever else, and you just hear about this, and you know that's just the tip of the iceberg with all that, right? So, like, if all that happened, yeah, I'm inclined to believe that some director mistreated a bunch of kittens. I mean, it's sad, but the older I get, I'm just more inclined to believe in the sliminess that exists behind the scenes, which is hopefully going away as we get a little more progressive, but we shall see.
Dan, where can we find you on the socials now?
I want to come at me about it.
DW
Caffrey on Twitter and Instagram, and my website is dancaffreywrites.com. Say hi. Share your thoughts. Share what your horror host name would be, because I would want to hear it.
Yeah, we might make that a post. I think that'd be fun.
That's really fun. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Justin, where can we find you on the
social media? You can find me on Twitter. I think it's @JustinGerber7 because over the last 10 years, at some point, I canceled like 6 of my accounts and I started getting disgusted with Twitter. You can find me on Instagram as well. I should also point out that the American Humane Association attempted to investigate the cruelty rumors on the set of Milo Notice. And while noting that the context had also heard the allegations, they were unable to verify them. The same report noted that several Japanese humane societies allowed their names to be used in connection with the film, and the film, quote-unquote, shows no animals being injured or harmed. So I just want to say that nothing was ever proved, so let's leave those people alone. And, you can find me on the Losers Club, too. You can find all of us in the Losers Club, too.
Yeah, you can find us all in the Losers Club, and we've got a lot of great content over there. And very varied different content, because we try to make sure there's not too much bleed over here at the Halloweenies. And you can find me, Wolfman Mac, which is Wolfman_Mac_Gerber on Instagram, and MackenzieJames25 at Twitter. I'm a newbie to Twitter, so bear with me. I'm not on quite as much as people would want me to be, but I'm getting there.
Throw him off a cliff.
don't Milo notice him.
Don't kill 100 Max.
Oh, good Lord. Well, that was fun. I'm stuffed. That was a lot of good candy. A lot of good treats and tricks, as it were. I think it was all those black and orange caramels. Do you remember those black and orange candies?
Wax orange and black wrapping. Were they like peanut butter? Yeah, they weren't good.
I don't even know
plastic
what
always
they
stuck
were.
To
they
it.
Were,
I don't
they
think my parents...
Even...
I don't think they let me eat those because you can
rightly
easily
so.
Like unwrap them and wrap them back up again, you know? Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today on another very special Patreon episode. This is a Patreon episode, yes? Or is this going to be on the main feed?
Main feed.
Oh, this is on the main feed. Well, here's a little preview of some of the extra stuff that you can get on the Rewind. We really do appreciate all your questions and love interacting with everybody. I hope you're looking forward to the other treats we have in store this month, which includes our main feed Flick Prom Night. This month, we've got our rental episode, a Sleepaway Camp, if I'm not mistaken, and then
Brian
we're also
Burnett's
doing
selection because he was on. He did our Witch tier, in which you're able to select a movie for us to cover. So
that's nice, very nice. So that's something to look into, folks. And then we're also going to be covering Leprechaun, starring Warwick Davis and Jennifer Aniston.
Audio commentary.
That's our audio commentary. That's our audio commentary this month. And then So have fun trick-or-treating, but remember, when the street lamps turn on, it's time to come home. But if you're one of the real Halloweenies, one of the real trolls, as Romero put it, we'll see you next time.
Wish I had you all along, just the two of us. I would hold you close to me, so close to me.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform, or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.